Post-Harlan Monologics. Number 00008. Recorded on December 30th, 2022. Production location, Post. Harlan. Texas. Keep on trucking. Part 1. Chapter 8.
The opinions of Maverick 88 are not necessarily the opinions of Maverick 88. Sensitive content warning. Viewer discretion is advised.
Now, buckle up. You are on the runaway train of thought. Ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, the one, the only, Maverick 88.
Ever be in a three-piece band, right? I play guitar, a variety of different guitars, right? I make music. I love music. I always have. I've always got a song in my head, right? And I've always had these imaginations of like forming a band, working with, and I've never done it. Really, it's the thing I do on my own, and I'm good like that. I'm content like that. But you know, when I was younger, I always thought of like being in a band and like getting on the road and traveling and getting all wasted and having all the girls and all that, just like anybody else. I'm a red-blooded all-American kind of guy, you know, at the end of the day. But if I had a three-piece band, I would have to probably call it the Three Almosts, right? The Three Almosts. What the fuck is that? Right? You say it, what the fuck is that? Three Almosts. Let me tell you what the Three Almosts are, what they mean, what that means to me. Before I ever got to my first rock and roll concert, there were three almosts that happened that never did, right? Because that's how almosts are. The first almost was Pink Floyd, The Wall, right? You're in seventh grade, right? A lot of really great albums came out, 79 into 80. It's probably the two biggest was Pink Floyd, The Wall, probably Led Zeppelin, In Through the Outdoor. And there was a lot of other ones too, but those are probably the two huge ones. And both of those factor into the three almosts. Go figure. Right? But the Pink Floyd, The Wall came out in 79. And I got it hot off the presses. I was just starting to listen to Pink Floyd at that stage of my life, like in the sixth grade, going into the seventh grade. And this thing came, it was on the radio all the time, you know, Another Brick in the Wall. Part Two was like a single, and then all of a sudden Comfortably Numb was on the radio. Holy shit, you know? I remember hearing that stuff, and I was like, wow. So I went and got that right away. It might have been the first edition, you know? I didn't keep it. I beat the shit out of it. I listened to it 100 million times. But it was a big deal. And you know, they did a very, very limited tour. I think they only played two places in the United States, if I remember right. Hey, they landed in LA and they did a series of nights. It was a really big production. That was a problem with it. And then over in New York, right, in my area, they played over on Long Island in Nassau Coliseum, again, like a few nights, like four, five, six nights or something like that. But they had this big production that they had all this staging crap and everything, so it was easier for them to just go to really huge markets and do multiple nights instead of moving all the stuff around. They would just rebuild everything every day, you know. I guess that's the logic behind it all. Who knows, but somebody knows. I almost got to go to one of those Long Island shows. I had a buddy in the seventh grade, right, who through his older sister, I guess, managed to score like a whole heap of tickets for one of the shows. And basically gave him like five or six for him and his friends to tag along. And I was kind of on the short list of one of those people that would go. I was not great friends with the guy. Dude was like the most popular kid in junior high, right? Rich, lived on top of the mountain and all. And I was friendly, and I was in the same class, but we were not like buds. I didn't do a whole lot of shit with them. But in the seventh grade, there was not a whole lot of kids who were like really lining up to go see Pink Floyd, you know, to go do drugs and experience all that. But I was. I was. So there was a situation, basically, where one of the people that wanted to go that he had asked was really iffy. Like, his parents wouldn't let him go. You know, go figure. You're like 12 years old. You're going to go off to New York to go see Pink Floyd. You know, that's not that. You don't send your kids off to do that at that age. But. So somebody was really iffy in it. And if that person couldn't go, I was next in line. And at the last moment, that person was allowed to go. And I didn't get to go. And I missed it. I missed it. Now, the next day or the following Monday or whatever, you know, everybody came back to school. Now you got like these five guys walking around wearing Pink Floyd the Wall concert t-shirts. I'm just like, fuck. And I had to sit and watch that the rest of the year, you know. You've got five different dudes and 5 days out of the week, and they would just arbitrarily wear their Pink Floyd shirt. It was just always the constant reminder of what could have been but wasn't. So that's almost number one. And right at the same time, you know, like I mentioned, the junior high, grade 7, 1979, In Through the Outdoor by Led Zeppelin came out, and they didn't follow it up with a tour right away. 1980, late, like in the summer, they started making preparations. They started to do some things around England, where they came from, all these bands. We were always into these English bands for some reason. I don't know what the fuck. What was on the radio? I guess you get what you get, right? Anyhow, they started, like, you know, doing some shows around England, and they were starting to make the plans. They were setting the dates and everything like that to come over to America and finally, you know, do a tour that included songs from the very popular, their final studio album, as it turned out, In Through the Outdoor. So we're into, like, early in eighth grade, I guess, at this point, when the tour dates were starting to come out. And I had a bunch of buddies by this time, you know, like going seventh into eighth grade, bunch of friends. Everybody was starting to take like guitar lessons, and we had a drummer in my neighborhood who was already really good. He'd been playing since he was like 7 years old, you know. A couple of guys started taking guitar lessons. One guy started taking bass lessons, and they were going to throw me up to be the singer. Like, I still can't sing, but I had the balls to do it, and I guess that's all that counted. And I used to write lyrics. I was very peculiar. I just whatever. And so we had this little band, and like we ended up naming it. I remember sitting in this guy's bedroom. He had a stack of like vinyl records. And we were just reading through album covers, looking for something that we could name our band, and we ended up settling on a Black Diamond, right? Black Diamond was the name of our band, the working title of the band at that point in time. We stole it from a Kiss song, right? I don't even know the Kiss song. I wasn't a big Kiss fan, but I'd take it or leave it. I wasn't huge about that, but he was, and he had the album, and I actually chose it, and I don't even know why or what. It was just one of those instances where you were young, stupid, kind of like Beavis and Butthead, and it just, quote-unquote, sounded cool. Didn't really have no reasoning to it. Not like the three almost. We got a reason here, right? Here's almost number two. Because I remember, I would come home from school one night on the school bus. One afternoon, as it was. And did whatever the hell I did at the beginning of eighth grade. I mean, maybe it was smoking cigarettes in the backyard. Maybe smoking pot. I started to smoke pot around, I don't know. Or just, grabbing some junk food and watching TV. And I ended up watching TV because here's how the story goes. I'm watching TV and like the news comes on, right? The news comes on the TV at some point, 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock. And there's like this news anchor, New York City, local news. And in the background, over his shoulder, is a picture of John Bonham from Led Zeppelin, right? I knew Led Zeppelin enough to know John Bonham when I looked at him, but it had his name underneath it too, Bonham, And I'm like, oh, so I turn it up and I'm like looking at it. And the guy's explaining that John Bonham fucking died, right? He died. I'm like, what the fuck? See, because in this band, that's why I brought it up, the whole Black Diamond thing. One of the kids that we had, one of the guitar players, he was going to be the rhythm guitar player, I think. He had an aunt that actually worked for Madison Square Garden. So we had an inside track to get tickets to go see Led Zeppelin, Led Zeppelin of all things. And, we were very confident that this was going to happen. This guy, it was a slam dunk, as far as he was concerned. And then it wasn't. Fucking John Bonham died. I'm like, oh, shit. I didn't know what to do. I was in tears, right? There was a couple people that died around that time, celebrities that, actually brought me to tears. And that was one of them. So beginning of eighth grade, John Bonham dies. We're not going to go to concerts. So my bass player guy, he lived, at the top of the hill. And then, one street over in the next neighborhood. We always used to hang out up there at that time, And so I go, running out the door. And I go run down the street up the hill. Cruising up to the top, out of the neighborhood. I go right past Frank Nora's house, right? I go right past Frank Nora's house. I get to the top of the street. I leave the neighborhood, go over to the next block, and run across the lawn. Bam, bam, bam. I'm knocking on the door. The guy answers the door. He's in tears, too. He saw it also, right? Oh, fuck. That hurt. That hurt. I think a lot of people felt that one at that time. So that was almost number two, right? That was all junior high stuff. And then the last one happened, and I'm not sure which year of high school it was. I'm thinking it was when I was a freshman, which would have been 81 going into 82, I think. I was probably in early 82, and The Who announced this big tour, right? The Who, another English band, number three in the three almost category. They were going to do a big show at Shea Stadium in New York City, right over Flushing, Queens. Yeah, it's gone now. It's got replaced, rebuilt, whatever, City Field they call it now. Or they called it when they built it. I don't know what the fuck they call it now. I'm out of the loop. They were doing this big concert with the Clash opening up for them, right? Who were huge at the time, too. So it was like this big fucking deal, right? And there was this guy, he's like a senior, big dude, running around the high school. And he was like the ticket scalper from Fast Times at Ridgemont High, right? He was like that dude. At least at that point in time. And for whatever reason, I gave him money, and he never gave me the tickets. He, fucked me for him, right? It was one of those deals where he's, senior and a freshman. Yeah, I fucked a freshman, right? Wrong. I got all my friends, and everybody got on top of this fucking guy, and I got my money back. But I never did get the ticket. And, it turned out his older brother was like a semi-rock star, local rock talent in the area, and one of the bands that played around locally and all the bars and everything like that, who I actually paid to go see, somewhere else in life. That guy was cool, his brother, as far as I'm concerned. Eat it, But, so that never happened. So that was a third of the three almost in my life. So if I ever get into a band with three people, three-piece band, that's what I'm calling it, the three almost, and that's what it's about. The one that wasn't an almost, the one that did happen, and it just kind of sort of happened. One day, up in one of the neighborhoods in Martinsville with a bunch of my friends hanging out, just, you know, smoking weed, drinking, smoking weed, drinking beer, like we do. And then, like, you know, somebody comes by in a car, and it's like, hey, there's a couple of people, they're all going to jump on the train and go to Manhattan. We're going to try to score some Grateful Dead tickets. You want to go? We get like, I don't know how many carloads of guys get, and we all go down like to the, where did we drive? I was going to say down to the Bound Brook, because it was right down the hill, Bound Brook. I think we drove out actually to Metro Park. And what's that, Edison or Island or Colonia or somewhere out there. We went up to the Metro Park because it had a direct line that went straight to Penn Station. Whereas our regular Raritan Valley line, you had to like switch over in Newark, something like that. So we drove first, you know, a further to get to a train station that went directly to Penn Station. And why Penn Station? Because on top of Penn Station is Madison Square Garden. So we went out there, and I had no idea. This was, when the fuck was this? Like October of 83. Right, 83 to 84. So I was in my sophomore year of high school. It's the beginning of my sophomore year of high school. And we were on a train going to Grateful Dead. Don't you know? You know, at that time, we were in the like mid to late afternoon heading into New York City. Everybody's heading out, right? And all the commuters are coming home. We're on the train going in. So like the trains were empty except for people who were going to the Grateful Dead concert. Coming and going on this train. It was our fucking train. They were calling it the Grateful Dead Express or something like that. So everybody was just like on drugs and tie-dye. And I wasn't a big like Deadhead or anything like that. I heard of them. They were probably like 55 down on my list of bands to listen to, given a choice. You know, I was kind of indifferent about it. But, you know, I knew probably 10 or 20 songs just from the people I hung around with, right? And they played some shit on the radio. Grateful Dead had some new-ish kind of album out the year or two before that. What was it called? Go to Heaven, right? Go to Heaven. I think that came out when I was in, it's probably like 79. It was one of those albums like in that 79, 80 era. It was just so loaded with pretty good stuff. And it was not a bad album at all. There's some pretty good songs on that one. But, yeah, so we're going, you know, it's October 83, we're heading to Madison Square Garden, and it's my first concert. And, you know, we went out and scalped tickets, and, you know, we had some old dude with us who was kind of like, just kind of showing us all the ropes. Some guy who was like in his 20s, and then the rest of us, you know, we ranged in age from like 18 down to, I guess, what was I, 15 at that time? 15, maybe 16. 83, do the math. You know, I wasn't quite 16 yet. I was turned 16 that year, right? Or did I? Did I just turn 16? I don't know. Yeah, I was 16. I was 16 for a couple of months already. So, kind of late to the game as it turned out. You know, somebody who was ready to go to a rock concert in 7th grade didn't get to one until the 10th grade, as it happened. But my first concert was Grateful Dead. Grateful Dead in New York, and you know, we got our tickets, and this guy also scored us some windowpane acid. You ever hear that? Windowpane? It's like this gelatin material. Instead of putting it on, like, the tabs, the paper tabs, or instead of dropping it in a sugar cube like the hippies used to do, or just straight onto your tongue. This was this gelatin material. It looked like somebody took, like, Vicks, what is it called? Vapo-Rub, the bottle. Peeled the label off it, flattened out the bottle, and cut it into little squares. You know, it looked like that. And it was just this material you put under your tongue, and it just melted away, right? So, he got a bunch of that, and I took a bunch of that. So we're all tripping, right? So we're all Grateful Dead. We're all tripping. This is our first, my first rock and roll concert. My buddies, most of my friends were older than me at this point in time. You know, the ones who were like a year older than me, they had gone to see Yes already before. That's what we listened to. It was just, we were psychedelic, you know, those years. My first 2 years of high school were heavily psychedelic times. I call it my hippie phase, but it was a lot darker than hippie stuff for sure. Anyhow, that was it. That was my first concert. That wasn't the Almost, you know. So coming and going. And the thing about that show, it was actually a famous show. I don't know. I didn't know at the time. I didn't even know immediately afterwards. But it turned out it's what the Grateful Dead fans, who are called Deadheads, right? The ones who follow them around. They record all the shows on the cassette tape, and they carry boxes of cassette tapes, and they got all, you know, I had a lot of friends who did that. I know about it. And this was a, what they call a St. Stephen, right? A St. Stephen show, which apparently was very rare. St. Stephen was a song that the Grateful Dead did in the 60s. It was way back, and it was kind of a peculiar song for them. Kind of peculiar in a lot of ways. It has like really good moments to it. There's a lot of like changes and stops, and it's a little bit weird, but it has kind of like some, like I said, some cool grooves and cool parts to it. Cool part where the guy screams, you know, I like that. Screaming in rock songs kind of works pretty good. So it was a St. Stephen show, and I just remember, like, as the next couple of years of high school went by, getting conversations, you're hanging around with a bunch of deadheads, because they were just everywhere. They were everywhere back then, you know. I had so many friends who were, and you know, you just sit around smoking pot, maybe grab a guitar, you know, just talking about shit. Kids still bad behave like that, you know. It's what we did back then. And they would talk about this dead show and that dead show. And like, these guys would follow them around. They've been like the fucking 30 dead shows or more, you know? And then be like, what about you, dude? What shows you been to? And I'm like, oh, I went to one, you know? You only went to one, man? It's like, well, that's not that big a deal to me like it is to you. Oh, okay. What'd you see? You know, you remember? And I didn't remember much. I mean, I had certain flashes of memories of all that, that whole night and everything like that. As far as the set list was concerned, and that's what they were really into. Yeah, I don't know. There was a couple of songs I was familiar with. I threw them out there, and they did the math, and they were able to figure, holy shit, dude, you were at a St. Stephen, man. You know, I was like, okay, what's that? I didn't even know. I didn't even know. No, I was blessed to be at a rare event for deadheads, and you know, I was that idiot that didn't even know how fortunate he was. So I was at a St. Stephen show, and I'm reminded of that constantly. Now, I go to church. I go to Orthodox church, and while we're having our Sunday services, you know, we got icons, right? But the Orthodox have icons. Icons are like posters of saints, basically, is the best way to put it, or one way to put it anyway. It's a form of art, but it basically, you know, it's imagery that shows saints, basically heroes of the faith. And we have a St. Stephen icon, a big one, right up front where you can't miss it. So every time I'm there, and I, you know, I'm either in the back by the door pulling guard duty, or I'm up front and center, because when I'm worshiping, that's where I go. I go right up front and center. I don't fuck around. I take it seriously. And it's like, I'm always looking. There's St. Stephen right there. I'm always remembering all this, and it's just funny how things in life kind of come back all around full circle, whatever stop on the way. So yeah, St. Stephen is something that's actually prevalent in my life. And St. Stephen is a very important figure in the Bible. I'm sure that there's a lot of deadheads that don't really know who the fuck St. Stephen even is, right? They know the song, but they don't know what's behind the song. St. Stephen was the first deacon of the church. He was assigned to take on some duties that the apostles just could not be bogged down with, right? Him, and then there was another guy, and he ended up performing miracles, right? He really knew the faith, like, deeply and inside out, and he was expressing himself loudly in the streets of Jerusalem. The things he spoke was against the the flow of the powers that were at the time, and he ended up being in trouble for it, you know, and he got brought to justice, you know, kind of like charges of blasphemy and things like that, and he would argue his case, and in the book of the New Testament that's called the Acts of the Apostles, St. Stephen got like his own like chapter and a half. And in one of those chapters, which is chapter 7, he is basically giving a sermon, right? And it's all out there, word for word. And in this, he explains the entire history from Abraham to the present time of the Jewish people, right? So it's like a condensed version of like the entire Bible and everything that happened along the way, and how the prophets were killed, and how people like the Sanhedrin that he was speaking to, you know, like in a court, were culpable for the murders, the assassinations of the prophets, and they got pissed off and they stoned them, they executed them right there, you know. St. Stephen was a great guy, and right like up until his death, he's like praying to God to forgive them. He could see God as he was dying, and you know, he just took it. He made his case and died a martyr, and is forever immortalized in Scripture with a really huge chunk. You know, a lot of people in the Bible, not every one of them gets his whole fucking chapter to himself. You know, St. Stephen is an important dude, and for all you deadheads out there that may stumble upon this, go read the Acts of the Apostles, chapter 6 and chapter 7, and then you'll know who this St. Stephen guy is and what it's all about. So yeah, I went to the St. Stephen show. That was my first concert, and all my deadhead friends were, kind of jealous. Most of my deadhead friends were around my age. Well, all my friends were around my age for the most part. I had a few of them that were like 5-6 years older than me, right? My deadhead friends in particular were for the most part my age or younger. There was a couple of them that were a year older. And I'm still friendly with all these people, you know, with Facebook and the way you stay interconnected and all that stuff through time. So the younger ones were the ones who would be jealous, because they were never really even old enough to have been there, you know? And I was there. So, yeah, deadheads. You know, deadheads, like I said, they were the ones who were like really serious about the Grateful Dead. They would follow them around. They'd go to concert after concert. You know, in the summertime is what happened. You know, people would get out of school, and these guys just find a way. They just, where the next Dead show is, they show up, and they do whatever it takes to get a ticket to get in. They're making tie-dye shirts or selling drugs, beg, borrow, steal, whatever. And that was the lifestyle. You know, when you're in high school and you're a deadhead, you did that all summer long. And then if there were shows during the year, during your school year that you could get to, you know, without running away from home, basically, you did that too. And there was a whole lifestyle that went with it, because now it's like you're basically a panhandler or a street hustler or some combination of both, and you're just doing your deal at train stations and at the parking lots of the event venues for the concerts. You're operating within a network, and there was a large network of deadheads. Yeah, I've seen a bunch. People would rent houses. Or I eventually was at a place that was, and this will probably give you a pretty apt description of deadheads if you're not familiar, but this is for people 50, 100 years out. Deadheads kind of look like this. There was a band, there was a cover band for the Grateful Dead, and then they had some of their own material. Dream something or another, or something another dream. And just like, you know, with the Pink Floyd The Wall concert, it was out on Long Island. Oh, what the fuck town was that? I don't even remember the name of it. It was on the South Shore. It was in Nassau. It was not that far out from Brooklyn and Queens. And the name of the town escapes me. But they had rented, they and some other people, like they had this whole entourage, like a club, and they rented a house out. And in that house, they had like set up a like a jam studio. And then there was just rooms for them to flop and sleep. And then there was like a giant living room where people just kind of hung out and smoked pot and passed out. So it was a big flop house, basically, for deadhead type of people. And the core of it was this band. You know, they were kind of like the driving force of it all. And they were, I mean, they played out. They played clubs and shit all over Long Island, New York City, whatever. So they were our working band, and they dressed in tie-dye shirts. What tie-dye is what, you take a white t-shirt, you kind of like ball it up, crumple it up, tie a lot of rubber bands or string around it, and then you'd mix it with a whole lot of varying colors of dye. And just run it through some kind of process, like in a washing machine, dryer, all that shit. And I've seen it done once. I never really cared for the style. It's not my thing. I was not a tie-dye kind of guy. But one of my deadhead buddies, that was his racket. He made tie-dye shirts, and then he would go to the concerts and sell them and trade and barter. He'd get his ass into the concert, right? So I was with him one afternoon while he was making a bunch of these things. So you end up with this shirt that's like a variety of colors, and we're really good at making them. You can kind of control where the colors end up. And then it's got these lines on them. That's what the rubber bands and the string and shit do. And it's really hard to describe it. It's a really colorful, vibrant style of clothing. And it's not restricted to shirts, t-shirts, but that's usually the way it went. I mean, I've seen people do like three-piece suits and tie-dye and shit like that. Pants, socks, shoes, everything. But it was basically t-shirts. And to this day, here in 2022, there's still people going around wearing tie-dye. When I'm at work, there's people, young people who are in their 20s are wearing tie-dye this and tie-dye that. And, you know, this whole kind of strain of deadhead slash hippie continues to reverberate through the culture even all these 50 years later, right? It's hanging on by a thread, but it's still hanging on. It's kind of remarkable. That's what, like, the shirts that the people wearing, that style of clothes. Things were loose-fitting, baggy, you know, at a time, the 70s and the 80s, people wore clothing tight, right? Tight clothes. The deadheads wore life like a loose garment, right? That's my old AA sponsor used to try to tell me, just wear life like a loose garment. Okay. Well, the Grateful Dead, the deadheads, they wore life like a loose garment. Clothes were kind of baggy, you know, oversized. They could move and flow. They did a lot of dancing, a lot of weird hippie dancing. It wasn't really like orchestrated, choreographed steps or anything. They just kind of wave back and forth to the music, like, you know, wind kind of blows a flower around in the field, you know, wildflowers in the grass. And yeah, they didn't wear the clothes tight like just about everybody else did, you know. And I don't mean anything. I'm just trying to describe what you see. The hair was long. Faces unshaven. Girls didn't shave their armpits, right? So everybody was just kind of like their wild self, you know. Now, everybody's were young. They were under 30. You know, the people in the band were in their 20s, late 20s. But the hangers-on, the people who would stop in and visit, you know, hang around for a while, they would be anywhere from 15 to the age of the band, you know. You had all kinds. But everybody was on the young side of life and just unkempt, I'll just call it what it is, unkempt. A lot of them not even bathed, you know, almost like homeless. So you had that kind of hobo sense of the people. And they wore life like a loose garment. And they're on drugs. Everybody's on drugs. But the idea of peace and nonviolence was kind of like at the heart of their interaction. Where me, on the other hand, I'm rough and tumble, and my clothes are tight, and I've got leather, and I like to incorporate cocaine and crank, you know, speed meth, and drink a lot of whiskey, and I wouldn't mind getting into fights and shit, and just having a good, loud ruckus of a time. So I didn't always fit in. I didn't always fit in with that shit. You know, even in my hippie phase, when I was like in a freshman in high school, into my sophomore year, when I did see the Grateful Dead, right? As it turned out, when I was going through that phase of time, I would, you know, at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, be like, "Peace, dude." And by like 7 o'clock in the afternoon, I'd be drunk and in a fight in the street somewhere with somebody, you know. So I was not really all in with the whole deadhead thing, but that's me. I'm trying to tell you about them in general. And maybe by now, I've said enough to kind of like draw a picture of what the life was, but it was basically like the life of a bum that would just follow a rock band around and do whatever it took to get into the show. And even if you didn't get into the show, you were on the scene out in the parking lot, outside the concert, and it was just a way of life. And then you would start to make friends because you had a lot of people doing the same shit at the same time. You'd start to meet people, and you'd learn where to find them at the next event. So the network established, you know. And this went on until, Jerry Garcia died. And then it got strung out. I mean, there's this element of people to this day. Other bands formed up, like, and I don't know nothing about this. You can ask Frank Edward Nora. He's a big fan of Fish, right? A lot of deadheads like flocked over to that. The remaining players in the Grateful Dead, they had a variety of like solo and group variations on the Grateful Dead music, and they would come out and do small tours around. I lost touch with it completely eventually, but that's what the Deadheads basically are and about, what they look like. I had a lot of friends who did that stuff, but the friends that I had that did that stuff, they were in high school when I was in high school, and they did it on a high school level, which was basically, like I said earlier, in the summertime, they would kind of drop their shit and go do things like this. But the rest of the year, they had to be back at school. And they got older, you know, it's their choice to do that year-round. With the Grateful Dead, you almost kind of sort of could. They toured a lot. That was what they did. So the Deadheads, Deadhead friends. Now, Deadhead, right? Deadhead. A lot of people won't know this unless you've been in the field of logistics and transportation. Deadhead is actually a trucking terminology, right? Deadhead means that you've got a trailer behind you that's got no content in it, right? You're dragging an empty trailer around in a truck means you're a deadhead. You're not doing anything, you're not making money, you're not hauling any shit, you're just dragging a trailer behind you, right? That's what it means to deadhead in logistics. And I don't know who among you deadheads actually know that. You know, there might be a couple of you that got a job somewhere driving a truck or whatever, but yeah, deadhead is actually a logistics term in trucking, right? It's trucking. Trucking is a Grateful Dead song, right? Probably their most well-known. Trucking, right? Got my chips cashed in. I don't remember the set list from the concert I went to, but almost assuredly they played that song because there was, you know, if there was like five songs that like I recognized during that night, trucking would have been one of them, you know? And very popular. I should go look at the set list. It's probably readily available on the internet somewhere. But anyway, I think Grateful Dead, that's the first song that comes to my mind. I had the Grateful Dead, they had a greatest hits album. I think it was called Skeletons in a Closet, if I recall correctly. I had that album. Truckin' was on it. I had Terrapin Station on cassette tape. I believe I had Go to Heaven at some point in time. I didn't listen to it a lot. I didn't listen to Grateful Dead a lot. I used to make fun of it, you know? I was damn Yankee at the end of the day, and I had a low regard for country music at that period of my life because I was all kind of urbanified and psychedelic, and you know, I thought country stuff was so hokey, and I was so high-minded listening to like prog rock bands and shit like that that were just so completely different than, you know, the hokey old music that my parents listened to when I was a little kid, which is what I like now. There you go. It all comes back around, don't it? I used to regard... I still do. Yeah, it holds true. Grateful Dead was basically country music on acid, right? By and large. I mean, there were some funky jams that they did later into the 70s. Get that wah-wah pedal out. You know, there was some cool stuff they did, like street level funk, Shakedown Street, things like that. I like that kind of, that element of the band was good, you know. And Truckin', I think, was one of the songs that were done by the bass player, if I remember correctly, whose name evades me right now. But he had a line of songs that he did that my preference, my taste for the Grateful Dead was more on that guy's lines, right? I was never a big fan of Jerry Garcia's guitar playing, the sound that he had, anything like that. It's just boring and repetitive and redundant. And I don't mean to critique the Grateful Dead. That's not what I'm here to do at all. But they had the Truckin' song, right? The Truckin' song. And, you know, that ties into Arlen, anyway, pre-Arlen. DFW, right? Dallas. There's a line in the song of the Truckin' song that mentions Dallas, and it talks about Dallas having this thing called a self machine, right? Dallas got the self machine, and there's a lot of debate to what that even means, you know. Here we go again with these like drug-induced lyrics, and all the mystery and question marks that go with it. And this is what you get in rock music a lot, you know, just. You know, with the guy alive to explain it to you, there remains, even to this day, ambiguity. I never knew what it was. I made some assumptions about it. You know, you would think maybe it was some, like, local band called the Soft Machine. Maybe it was, like, a reference to, like, a political posse, you know, the political machine. Well, that's, you know, Soft Machine. In Dallas, you know, who's ever like controlling the action around here. And when I go and look up and read about it, that there is a possibility, an element of that, but there is really nothing official, you know, that called it like the Soft Machine. So I don't know what the fuck. I don't know, and a lot of people don't know. But I don't know if anybody knows. The guy who wrote it might not even know. He might have just been stoned at the time. Maybe Soft Machine was something very personal to him. I don't know. But Dallas is mentioned in the song Truckin', so that kind of ties back to the whole ambiance of post-Arlen monologics right there, right? Truckin', yeah, it's Chips Gaystein. And we had a senior talent show, right, in high school, so we're continuing. We're going from my junior high into my high school, and my first concert being the Grateful Dead after the three almost disappointments. And get to senior year, right? Now, everything comes back around, right? The band that once was deemed Black Diamond, right? I mentioned the Black Diamond band. Well, those guys kind of held it together. They all kept taking their lessons. They all kept jamming. They started building up a repertoire. They started playing out wherever they could, you know, wherever somebody was at little parties or whatever they did. I don't know. I got myself disconnected from them because I left. It, like in the eighth grade, and went my own direction away from all of them. these guys kind of stayed together. You know, they were into music, and I was into music, but I was into drugs and the whole scene that went with it. So I went off on my own tangent, basically divorced myself from my own crowd to enter into whatever, you know, what was ever behind door number two out in the world. And come around senior year, these guys are still playing. They were playing under another name, which, you know, was equally as stupid as Black Diamond as far as I was concerned. It was like Newer Heights or something like that, right? Newer Heights or New Heights. And, okay, you know. And I bring them up again because here they are. There's a senior talent show going on. And somebody in the band approached me and asked me if I wanted to come back with them and get up and do a Doors song, right? Like they learned how to do a Doors song, and they wanted me to come up and sing it, you know, in like a senior talent show. And I thought that was just plain fucked up, because I had nothing. I was the class rebel in high school. I had nothing to do with anything that was. I went to high school to meet girls and buy drugs, basically. Party up, be stoned, and I was always in trouble. There was always problems. I was damn near kicked out, you know, a dozen times. I did not take any part in any kind of extracurricular activities at the school. I was out of there like a bat out of hell, and I was in there late, you know. And when I was there, I wasn't really there. So it was just weird to me, but my friends were like, yeah, dude, that would be cool, man, you know, because they always were. You know, that same year I was asked to like join the baseball team because I was such a good baseball player in junior high. They needed a pitcher and they wanted me to just come in and be a varsity baseball player, having not played in 3 years, right? Just like that. And I was like, nah, no way, you know. My friends were like, dude, that would be cool. Why don't you just go and just kill all the fucking jocks, right? Because I was that good. Just go and just stick it right up their fucking ass, man. You think so? And they're like, yeah, go do it. So I talked to them again, and they're like, yeah, that's great. And the coach says you would have to cut your hair. I say, go fuck yourself, right? That was a matter of pride. That's who we were back then. Burnouts and the hair and everything. So that didn't happen. But this talent show thing almost happened. Here's another almost, right? I was asked to come and do this Doors song with the band that I helped form in junior high that I walked away from to go be a fucking burnout, right? And not only were they going to do a song with me, they had another song planned with a couple of my other friends singing. They were going to do what? A Grateful Dead song. Which one? Trucking, right? So they're going to do Trucking. So those guys get up on the stage, right? So the band's up there playing. And, you know, I'm out in the fucking senior parking lot. I'm drinking Budweiser Tall Boys. I'm snorting crank. And I'm all just wired up. My friends are just like kind of like getting me all amped up. Dude, this is going to be great, man. You know? And I'm like doing fucking cocaine in the bathroom. Like the main bathroom. I think they call it the A-Wing, right? Right behind like all the offices. Like the principal and everything like that. Across from the cafeteria and the school. Because the assembly hall was right back in there. I never even went to. I was in that school 4 years. And there was like a hallway I never went down, right? And that was the only time. I went back there fucking stumbling drunk, right? And all amped up. Totally high as a fucking kite. And I was actually helping my old buddy, right? The guy with the John Bonham story. Move his bass amp and equipment in. I dropped the fucking thing. He was all upset. I'm like, dude, you know? He's like, it still worked, so let's move along. Big old heavy, like big PV amp or something like that from the early 80s. I got it up on the stage and I just went off to the side and they started playing. You had a crowd of people were out there in all the seats, right? It was the assembly hall, you had a stage, and you had all this kind of, you know, like concert seating basically. It was an assembly hall. What do you call it? But it was like half full, right? There was a lot of people who were participating in events, and there was just a lot of onlookers and shit like that. And it was just a rehearsal. So you had like a row of teachers who were like assessing the talent, the shows, for whatever they were looking for. Who the fuck knows? I don't know. I don't care. And, you know, so the band's up on the stage and they're getting into trucking. And two of my friends, one good, really good friend, another guy who's just a dude in my class, right, my grade, they're just sitting on the end of the stage. Not even in the center, they're just off to the side, and they're holding microphones in their hand. And it was just like this really, I gotta say it, I don't mean to be critical, this is really boring, uninspired rendition, you know. You could hardly hear them. They were not animated. They were just kind of holding it. I think they were both scared is what it was. And I don't blame them, you know. It's not easy to get it up in front of people. And it's a trucking, got my chips cashed in. You know, out of key, out of tune. Not in time with each other. And it's just kind of like flat and lame. It's like, man, you know. I'm standing there, it's like, they're gonna call me up to go and do this shit too, and I don't wanna be that guy. You know, I don't wanna do this, fuck this. You know, then they clear the stage, and one of the guitar players comes over, and he's like talking to me, I'm like, you know, I don't know, I wanna do this shit, man. I don't know, I wanna do this. He's like, you gotta do it now, come on, we're all set, you gotta do it now. But he talked me into it, right? I remember that we were doing a Break On Through, right? Break On Through by The Doors. It's a real short song, real easy song. And I could sing The Doors effortlessly. I can't sing, but really Jim Morrison couldn't either. So I just happened to kind of like be in his same like octave range and tone and shit. And you know, I got a voice that can do that easily. And when I was drunk and I was cranked up and coked up, I'd let it fly. And half of it is just having the courage to just open it up and let it go, right? And because I was so fucked up in the manner that I was, I had that courage that night or that afternoon where my buddies who were singing The Grateful Dead didn't have. So I get up there and they start into the song. And I had told the guy, all right, let's just keep it to the short version, right? Because I didn't really want to be up there and do it. The Doors had two versions of the song. They had a live one, they had a studio one. Studio one was like, you know, 1967, real short, meant for 45, so they kept everything 3 minutes and under. And so it was a real short kind of blow-through song. I said, let's just do it like that. Let's not do the Break On Through 2, which was from their live album, Absolutely Live, which was significantly longer, had extra parts in it. So what happens? I'm up there on the stage, and we're going through it, and then all of a sudden, I kind of just like walk off. Not off, but off to the side. I light up a cigarette. You know, I'm like getting into it. I'm gone, right? The teachers are all like, what the fuck? You know? I'm walking around the stage with a cigarette. We weren't allowed to smoke, like, in the school. Well, anywhere on the school ground. We couldn't smoke. We did all the time. But, like, inside on the stage in front of everybody with a whole row of teachers. I had to be, like, 6, 7, 8 teachers right there. I didn't give a shit. And they're just jamming in the background. It's kind of, you know, Doors. I have a lot of repetition. You just play the same shit over and over, and then Jim Morrison just does his antics. They hold that little rhythm together, and he comes back and just makes up whatever. And I start singing all the parts for the long version of the song. The guitar player is like, I thought we were just going to do the short one. I'm like, I don't know. Smoke a cigarette, you know, jump around. But like the girls in the crowd, they were like getting into it like it was an actual show. I was like, everybody's like cheering and applauding, and you know, we finish it out. You know, before I was even done, I think I even lit a second cigarette. And the fucking teachers were pissed. They're screaming. The band's still playing. And wow, the applause was actually, I was like, as far as I could recall, the only time in my life I actually got applause for anything. I don't know. Like, that could be wrong. But it was very interesting. And it became, like, obviously, I broke their rules. They were pissed. They said, no, you're not going to be in the show. And that's fine. I didn't give a shit. The show was, like, the next day or the day after, right? The actual talent show. And a bunch of people, you know, that hung around down in that wing, right? Down that wing was like, what do you call it? It's like all the people who were like in the band, like the football band, you know, the marching band, that's what they call it, right? All the musical and drama people, the school, like hung out down back there, down this wing, where I never had gone down before. And they were coming up to me on the day of the rehearsal, or actually the show, the talent show, saying, look, man, what you did up there when you were singing was really cool. Everybody loved it. We're going to sneak you in, right? We know you're not supposed to be here, but we're going to sneak you in. We got this plan. We worked it out with the band. We have a way for you to, like, climb up a ladder and get on a roof and come down through the, you know, they, like, had this whole fucking scheme set up for me to, like, sneak into the school and, like, come in through the back curtains and just start singing the doors, you know? I think it would have been cool. And my friends were like, this is great. You know, a whole carload of us, like, drive me over and get me set to sneak into the school. And they had police posted everywhere. The police heard that this was going to happen somehow. Somebody heard, somebody told a cop, and they had stationed cops, like, at every exit just to keep my ass out. That's how fucking weird that was. Again, I was all fucked up and everything like that. They wouldn't let me in. I couldn't sneak in the back way. They had it blocked up. So I never got inside. What a big deal they made out of all that shit, though. We tried to make fun out of it, and that was it. That was my last hurrah in high school, I suppose. We graduated shortly thereafter. So that was it. That's the story. But we had trucking going on. Those guys went up and did their thing, right? They did their trucking. I have no idea how it came off because they wouldn't let me in the building. And so that was that, you know, trucking.
It is with regret that, due to time constraints, we must pause the story here and continue it at a later time. Please look for our next release, Chapter 00009. Keep on Truckin'. Part 2.
Thank you for tuning into Post-Arlen Monologics. Please understand that this project is meant to be part of a long-term archive as a series of snapshots reflecting a distant past. We are not seeking advertisers, but may at times accept private anonymous donations to help mitigate production costs. Further information involving this project and archived releases of Post-Arlen Monologics can be accessed over the World Wide Web at postarlen.com and at onsert.com. Comments, critiques, and inquiries may be submitted to Maverick through email at maverick88@postarlen.com.